Today is September 29th, and we're at the Concord Free Public Library down in the Special Collections Room with James Powers and Henry Dane representing the Concord Rod and Gun Club. Is it the Concord Rod and Gun Club?
It is the Concord Rod and Gun Club, Inc.
Okay. So let's
I'm not
start.
Sure that we are representing the club because they have no idea that we're here.
Oh, they don't have any idea here. Representing themselves as members of the Rod and Gun Club. Why don't we start with you, Jim, since you have on that beautiful tie. Can you say my name is?
My name is Jim Powers from Stowe, Mass.
And you're
past member of the Concord Rod and Gun Club for many years. And
your date of birth?
9/21/41.
9/21/41. Could you tell me just a little bit about your people and where you were raised?
I was born in Concord, lived initially on 17 Grant Street, moved to Neshottoc Hill in the 50s, resided there until I was married, and then moved to Stowe after that.
Was your dad a hunter? How does hunting figure in this?
Back in my father's day and time, the young men, I suppose, were all by nature hunters. The gun club sprang up from a group of hunters and fishermen. It was established probably, I would guess, in somebody's kitchen or dining room. I graduated to a building on Main Street, probably number one Main Street, now I think known as the Eads Building, where they, at that time, there was a third floor, which had a major hall and meeting rooms and so forth, and the club held its meetings and gatherings there.
Starting in?
Oh, I would guess the late 40s, early 50s. Prior to the purchase of the land up on Strawberry Hill Road, that's where they used to meet. And I recall as a young man, kid actually, going to the meetings. Whether I had a choice in it or not, I don't really recall, but I do recall going to some of the meetings. And also going on an occasional crow hunt, no less, back in the probably the mid-50s, early 50s, on Saturday mornings. I'd go out to the Virginia Road area, up to Old Road, Niagara area, and have a crow hunt. Take a stuff owl and put it up on a post somewhere. With permission from the farmers, I suspect the crows were a nuisance to the planting of crops and so forth, and used to go on crow hunts. And then I was involved in the club myself over the years until I moved out of town, had a family of my own, and became an occasional hunter as opposed to an avid hunter, and then just simply got away from it. But the club back in the early days, back when they were at 1 Main Street, and after that, used to sponsor disabled vets fishing days on a Saturday or a Sunday. I recall going out Monument Street, I think it was, to a piece of property out there that one of the members had access to either through ownership or a friendship with somebody who owned it. And they would arrange for school buses to go to the VA hospital in Bedford, I believe, and other places, and pick up disabled vets and bring them out, wheelchairs, crutches, and the membership and their kids would be there to assist these fellows to fish, baiting the hooks, taking the fish off, or whatever was necessary, depending on the ability of the veterans.
Was there a particularly accessible riverbank there?
It was a small creek or a large brook up on Wyman Street, as I remember, and it was fairly accessible, and it was stocked by the club, you know, 3 or 4 days beforehand. From the fisheries hatchery place would stock it quietly so that nobody would know about it, and there'd be something left for the vets to catch. They also, eventually, when they get the clubhouse and the pond up on Strawberry Hill, did the same thing up there. And lots of good memories. Lots of good memories.
Let's give Henry a turn here, and we'll come back to you then.
All right.
Can you say my name is?
My name is Henry Dane.
And your date of birth?
My date of birth is 1936.
Maybe you tell us a little bit about your people and where you live.
My people? Well, let's see. I was born in New York City. My father was in the radio and advertising business. I went to public schools in New York City, and then I went through various, I wandered through graduate schools of various kinds and ended up being a graduate of Harvard Law School in 1970. I moved to Concord in, I think, 1966, after spending time in various schools and living in London for a couple of years and teaching at the University of Pennsylvania and Union College. And when I came to Concord, I had three children. They are now in their, I had three children. They are now in their 40s, and then I had one more child who is now in his early 20s. I practiced law in Boston in the early 70s at a firm that was then called, named Hale & Dorr. And then I came out to Concord and established my own practice, and I've practiced law in Concord since January of 1973, and I'm still doing that at the age of almost 75.
Are there traditions of hunting or fishing that go back in your family?
None whatever. What happened was that my parents sent me away to summer camp at an early age, starting at the age of 5. And I spent every summer, the whole summer, at various summer camps from the age of 5 until about the age of 15 or 16. And then after that, I worked at some summer camps and during the summers and took a great liking to the outdoors. I remember one of these camps that I went to in Connecticut, which was staffed largely by guys who had just come back from the Second World War, encouraged boys, and it was an all-boys camp, to go to the commissary, take out a couple of shelter halves, and get some eggs and bacon from the kitchen and go out in the woods and camp on their own. And I would do this frequently. And I remembered all of these experiences, how you learn the hard way about, like, how you cook your breakfast inside a tent when it's raining, you know, which is something you'd do when you were 12 years old, but probably you'd have enough sense not to do if you'd done it once or twice before. But I used to, you know, do a lot of, hiking, mountain climbing. I was actually the president of the Haverford Mountaineers, a rock climbing group at my college when I was in the late 50s. And I actually, and it's, and I, and when I have returned to the college for reunions, I see that the piton that I drove into the dormitory wall to rappel down the side of the dormitory is still there. And I also, when I was in my early 20s during college, college vacations would lead groups of, you know, of high school age students on, you know, like week-long trips in the White Mountains where you carry everything that you carry everything on your back. And, you know, so I had a lot of experience in the outdoors. Although the only hunting that I had done was I got pretty good at catching snakes with my bare hands and catching frogs when I was young. In fact, I continued that with my children when I started, when I came to Concord, because there's a pond here, it's called Fairyland, where we would go with my kids. And in those days, there still were snakes there. I don't know if there are now, but we would go out there and we would catch snakes and frogs and so on and bring them home and put them in an aquarium in our dining room. So that's kind of my background in this area. And my first experience with the Rod and Gun Club was going up there to one of the July 4th outings, I guess as we call them, with my kids when they are very young, where they had these wonderful, you know, it was like a fair where they cooked lobsters and, you know, had all kinds of food and activities for the kids. And it was a big event in the town, probably until about 20 years ago when many things changed, including the town started its own July 4th party in the Emerson playground. And I think the population, the demographics we call them now, changed so that a lot of people had summer homes that went away to Chatham and Nantucket and wherever they, you know, went, like Winnipesaukee, and just weren't around in the summer. That's, I think, when I met Jim's father. I don't know if Jim mentioned the fact that his father, Jim Powers Sr., is that what?
Close enough.
Was a real hero in this town. Very highly regarded as a real estate broker and as a philanthropist and a guy who had good old-fashioned Democratic values, the Tip O'Neill type of lunch pail Democrat from the old days.
Lunch pail Democrat.
That's what we call them. Yes, it's essentially in today's political spectrum, you call it the Democrats who are fiscally conservative and socially conservative. I guess that would be probably a shorthand way of describing it. But the old-fashioned Democrats. I remember I was the attorney for the Concord Housing Authority, and we were back in the days when we did a lot of construction for low and moderate and handicapped housing. And there was a big dispute about a particular, I think it was the handicap project on Thoreau Street, and Jim Powers came out and stood up and spoke in favor of this, he certainly that helped. Stimulated my admiration for him that he had the courage to do that. He was the president of the Rod and Gun Club for how many years?
Off and on, probably 15 years. I think he was president 5 or 6 times.
And I had dealings with him then, although I was not a member at the time that he was president. I do remember that when I ran for the state legislature in 1984, I was up at the Rod and Gun Club and had my picture taken with him, and didn't help me enough. Didn't help me that much, but it was probably me and not him.
Did you have your lunch bucket with you?
I don't, but I don't believe I did. It wasn't lunchtime. But then one of my maxims is it's never too early for lunch. So I didn't get to join the club until, my youngest son was about 6 or 7 years old, so that would have been in mid-70s. And I was encouraged to join by a man named Art Stetson, who was still around as a member of the club. He's one of our senior members. He was a his wife was a secretary to the Board of Appeals, and when she retired from the town, working for the town, her name was Marge Stetson, and she's still around too. I saw her yesterday. She came to work for us at our office, and so I would see Art, and they would always be encouraging me to come down and join the club, which eventually I did, and I took my son down there, and because I wanted him to learn how to shoot and to have, you know, to do the things that we do at the club. So I've been a member since then, which would be what, about 20 years? Would that be right?
70 when?
Early mid 70s, so that's about
25.
No, I'm sorry, not mid-70s. My son was born in 1986, so it would be the mid-90s, so that'd be about 15 years, which seems right. Then Art Stetson talked me into becoming the treasurer of the club, which I did for a while, and then I've been involved in the management or the administration of the club since then, almost continuously as a member of the what we call the Board of Governors or as an officer, and then I've been the president for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years.
Let me get back with Jim for a minute here. I wanted to hear more about the July 4th celebration, where it was held, what some of the events were, and who would come to a thing like this.
I guess we probably should preface that with the reason for the July 4th. As I mentioned, the club initially was down on a meeting hall on Main Street, and there was some movement among the members to try and find their own place, which was unsuccessful. And I would imagine, if memory serves me, that at some point in time a parcel of land came available up on... there was talk of going up to Vermont at one point in time and buying land in Vermont so that the members would have a place to go to hunt and fish, bow and archery and the rest of it, without getting in the hair of local folks. As is the case today, I'm sure. Anybody discharges a weapon in town, the phone rings at the police station and so forth. And this parcel of land on Strawberry Hill Road came up for sale. And the club had been running raffles and other things, trying to raise money to get something started to build a treasury so they could afford to buy or build or do something when this lot of land came up. And my dad The price, of course, relatively speaking at the time, was expensive. And my dad tried to convince key players in the club at the time that they should buy it and so forth. And it was back and forth, and finally there was a resolution to make an offer on it. But then they, how are we going to pay for it if we buy it, question came up. And that's when initially they started running sportsman shows at the State Armory over in Concord. And for a number of years back in the late 40s, early 50s, they ran a sportsman show, rented out booths, put in a canvas fishing tank probably 30 or 40 feet long and 20 feet wide on the beautiful hardwood basketball floor, which everybody loved. And it was quite successful. And then that gave them the resources to buy the land and then begin to build the building.
Tell us about the land itself. How large a parcel?
As I recall, it was 40 acres. And it included a piece of property that ran from the club down to Barrett's Mill Road, actually including, I think, the old site of the Barrett's Mill. The waterway went down through there. There were a couple of small dams that probably sluiced water into the mill. And
What water was it?
It's the waterway, the drainage from the club pond as it exists today. So if you go downstream from the club driveway, which is essentially on the dam, down below that dam all the way down to Barrett's Mill Road, there was a strip of land around that brook that came with the property or was picked up within a year or two of the purchase of the main parcel.
And the name of the brook?
I don't know. I want to say Hops Brook, is that what it was? I'm not sure.
I think it may be Second Division Brook.
It was nothing more than a...
And the pond was Angier's Pond.
Angier's Pond.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No, I don't recall. But anyway, I remember distinctly after they had bought the place, they carved out a lot on Barrett's Mill Road. And at the time, I worked for Dad in real estate. And I happened to sell the lot to the fellow who built the house there. So they wanted to maintain control of the water downstream so that neighbors couldn't interfere with the pond. But it was 40 acres, the main parcel. And they sited, they found the site for the clubhouse where it presently exists up on the little bit of a bluff overlooking the... Actually, it wasn't a pond at the time. It was more of a swamp. And so the sportsman shows were the driving force to raise the initial down payment, if you will. And then they contracted with a pre-cut log outfit up in Maine, I think, drew a set of plans up for a building, had members who were in the construction business donate their time, and poured a foundation. The folks from Maine come down, measured it to make sure, and they produced this kit, which was delivered on flatbed bed trailers. And the members showed up for months at a time on weekends and tried to put the puzzle together, and which they eventually did. And then... over the years, they've added on to it once or twice, and they've made it a nice place. But at that early juncture, they were finding the cost of having the pond dredged was quite expensive. I guess there was a pond committee or something going on. And they reported to a meeting that the cost of doing this was so many thousands of dollars, which didn't go over too well. And my dad offered to see what he could do, and he found a contractor that was willing to buy the loom once it was dredged out and dried out.
By the
dredgings, if you will, from the pond. So they contracted with this fella. And instead of us having to pay him, he paid us. And he dredged out the pond, created two or three islands, which exist out there today, small islands. They took all the sludge from the bottom of the pond, and they piled it in what was at one point, or is now, a parking lot down close to the dam, to the right as you come in over the bridge by the dam. And they had 20, 30-foot piles of loom there for a year or two, which every so often this guy would come in and turn over and mix and so forth until it became saleable loom, and off he hauled it. And so instead of having to pay to make the pond, we get paid for the pond. So that gave us a very nice setting with the pond, and we put in a little cement pier dock that they used to fish off and tie a couple of rowboats to and so forth. It also gave us better fishing, and at some of those July 4th outings, one year I was in charge of it, and very stupidly, I guess, convinced that everybody we should have log rolling and canoe tilting just like they did in the Boston show. And that was unanimously agreed upon, but of course I was the only one that was willing, one or two who were willing to do it. And I think it was either the first or the second year in canoe tilting, I got jousted straight back into the canoe. I think that was the last time that we had the canoe tilting, if I recall. Once was enough on that.
You got bruised up pretty bad.
I got set back on my keister, and my back of my head hit the metal crossbar on the canoe, and I said, I said, that's why we don't do much more of canoe tilting, I don't think. I forget who was the log roller, but I figured the canoe tilting would be a drier occupation. It was, but the landing was a little bit harder. But that's how those outings, which were twice a year, actually, they were July 4th and Labor Day, and they were designed to pay the mortgage, because we did raise enough money at the sportsman shows to down payment and get started, but they had to pay a mortgage. So the July 4th outings were designed to be the big producers twice a year to raise money to pay the bills and so forth.
Now, the sportsman shows, tell me a little bit, were these people who sold hunting products? Or?
It would be, they would typically have a water tank. You'd have all the guns, fishing rod companies, the gun companies, anything to do with sporting would rent booths and people would come in. There would be movies being shown, hunting and fishing movies, and like shown in the side rooms up front on the armory. And local business owners would have booths to promote their business. My dad, Marty, my brother, in his office, there's a picture of either he or I or both of us sitting on a counter that my dad made. He was a woodworker in his spare time, and made a counter that sat in the front of the booth. And he would display real estate magazines and prop up pictures of houses for sale and so forth. The hardware store would probably have a booth and have the latest in rakes and hoes or shovels or whatever. It was a big draw, and it lasted for 5 or 6 years, I would guess, until they had enough money to proceed with the club. It was labor intensive, as was the outings on July 4th and Labor Day, but it was necessary. But when it was no longer necessary, like any club, the membership of 300 or so, there's usually only about 20% that do all the work, so they were getting worn out from all these things, and they had the club on a reasonably stable financial basis, so the sportsman show. And again, as Henry said, the demographics change. People no longer gravitated to hunting and fishing because of development that wasn't the land. I mean, places where I used to go hunting and fishing and flying kites now have houses and buildings and neighbors and so forth. But which is why most of us stopped hunting around this neck of the woods, and probably drove us to the sea duck hunting we used to do, which was another hobby that came from the club. A lot of club guys just go coot shooting down the ocean. No neighbors, no roads, no telephone wires, no complaints, and a lot of fun. But that's how the sportsman shows and the outings figured into it. Early on, it was the lobster and clam and the fact that people were more stay-at-home at that time, and it was a big community thing. For a number of years, I remember we gave away a pony up the club, and we used to parade it around town. We, otherwise known as me, was put in charge of parading the pony around town with a placard, you know, win this pony on July 4th or Labor Day or whatever, up at the club. We used to keep horses. One time we had a couple of horses or a pony and a horse at most times. And I was charged with pony rides for the July 4th and Labor Day thing. So I used to bring the horse and pony up and give pony rides. They had a little midway in which they had different little booths, if you will, that you could knock over bowling pins or pop balloons or whatever, all kinds of little gaming things that folks could do, along with the trap range. They used to do a little trap shooting and so forth, and eventually the archery members became a big part of the club, and they had an archery shoot at the end of that thing, and you know, a quarter here, half a dollar there, eventually all added up. That's how they made their money.
What a story. Tell me in more detail about this demographic change, the shift that began to occur.
Well, Henry? This is not scientific, but it's interesting that the number of members of the club has stayed very stable. In fact, has grown since the time that Jim is talking about, and we find that most of the social and fraternal organizations in recent years have had a lot of trouble keeping members for all kinds of reasons. Reasons having to do with air conditioning, forms of amusement that are available at home. I mean, you can stay home and watch amazing stuff on television. You can rent movies. You can any movie you want to see. People have, and I think also the whole social and legal atmosphere has tended to keep people at home, such as the very strict enforcement, at least in Massachusetts, of drunk driving laws tends to keep people at home and not go out and socialize. The gun laws, of course, have been an issue, as Jim mentioned. I mean, not only are there houses that have been built, but the hunting seasons have been shortened. Like in Massachusetts, deer hunting is, I think, like 1 week in December, and it's with shotguns only. You can't discharge a firearm within 500 feet of a dwelling or within 200 feet of a road, and so that leaves very little real estate available for hunting with firearms. And of course, the deer know exactly where those zones begin and end, and they also seem to know exactly when the deer season begins and ends as well. Which I think, by the way, is one of the reasons for the growth of archery and bow hunting, because it is subject to so much less restriction in terms of where, and the seasons are much longer, and because the licensing and the licensing requirement with firearms have become
so much more stricter, and there are none for bows, even though they have become extremely efficient and lethal. The club started out as being a working man's club. I think that's how people have referred to it, or a blue-collar club, and which is why there were people available to do all the construction work, because there were a lot of people in the trades. We, you know, had plumbers, electricians, contractors, you know, you name it, welders, masons, all that, who were members of the club. The dues were very modest, and even to this day, almost all the work at the club is done by members. We have no employees, very little of the work, except things like, you know, very little of the work is done by paid professionals. It's interesting because Jim's brother became a member of another club in town. There's another sporting club in town called the Musketaquid Sportsman Club, and that was considered to be the upper class club, the high class club, which had higher dues, limited membership, and was kind of considered to be. And Jim can probably tell you more about the distinctions, but
spelling
Musketaquid. Musketaquid, I think.
So these two clubs sort of ran parallel to each other.
Yes, I guess that's right. And we have a very cordial relationship. And as you might guess, with the son of a former president of our club having been a president of Musketaquid and is still an active member there, and we cooperate in all kinds of things, including sharing information about insurance and real estate taxes and things of that kind. But the demographics have changed, and there are not as many people in this area who are, you know, come from that background or from those occupations. And so over the last maybe 10 years or so, we've been getting a lot of people who work in Boston who are stockbrokers and physicians and, computer people, and who are now, interestingly enough, there seems to be kind of a revival of interest in the outdoors and in the shooting sports, part of which I think is stimulated by the general negative social attitude toward this. I wouldn't call it not a rebellion, but I see it as a reflection of a desire to.
I think it's probably a natural desire to return to the outdoors.
Yeah, to return to the outdoors, and also to kind of maybe participate in something that people see as a kind of a disappearing kind of. Something that people don't want to see die, and the direction of society seems to be a kind of, the grain of society seems to be running the other way, at least around here in Massachusetts. So I think it's something that piques people's interest. I think we've seen a big increase in interest in trap shooting, club now has about, I think, 3 competitive trap teams. We have
two. Could you go into more detail about that for the lay reader?
Lay reader, yes. What is trap?
Yeah, what is trap shooting?
Trap is a shotgun sport where you shoot at flying targets, which are, they call them birds or clays, they're no longer clay because they are now biodegradable, but they are discs about 4 inches in diameter, painted a bright orange, and they get launched out of a machine which throws them at random, not at random times, but in random heights and directions. And you get 5 shooters lined up in a row, left to right, and each one in turn calls for a bird, and the bird is launched. Now in this modern world, by a voice-activated microphone, and it gets thrown out in front of you, and you shoot at it, and then you shoot in turn. The 5 people go around, and for one round you go around 5 times, so that at the end you've shot 25 shells, the scores will range from anywhere from, well, depending how good the people are, from 12 to 24 or 25. And it's a very challenging sport. It's the kind of thing, the first time you try it, you think it's amazing you could hit any of them at all, because it's a small moving target at a considerable distance that you're trying to hit with a shotgun. And it kind of reminds you of, you know, the county fair kind of things when you went to as a kid, you know, and now you can do, this is something you can do as an adult, and it's very challenging. It's kind of, I would, you know, put it along in terms of the kind of the mental concentration and coordination. It's kind of along the lines of golf in terms of being frustrating and challenging at the same time. I say that as a person who has played golf only 3 or 4 times in my life and only under compulsion. And that is a big draw for people. I think it involves the use of firearms. It involves skill. It is considered, I think, to be something of a gentleman's sport, and it doesn't involve killing any animals. So I think people who are revolted at the idea of killing animals for sport still can actively participate in trap and have fun doing it.
So animal rights doesn't necessarily include clay pigeons?
No, it does. Shooting trap or skeet, which is a variation on that, requires considerable hand-eye coordination and a lot of practice. And in my later years, when my 2 boys and my daughter, as a matter of fact, were in their teens, I introduced them to trap shooting up at the gun club. And particularly one of my sons became pretty adept at it, and forced me to concentrate a little bit more to stay ahead of him. He became a pretty good marksman including buying his own specialized shotgun for trap shooting. I still have the original shotgun that I bought when I was 16 years old.
Which is?
Winchester Model 12. Bought it from Bill Ryan. As a matter of fact, I know it was 16 because when I was 15 for Christmas, I was given a single shot 410 shotgun. And the following year, when coot season came around, which is usually late September, mid October, I went coot shooting with my dad down off of Manomet in Plymouth.
Spelled.
Manomet, Manomet. It's a bluff south of Plymouth Center where today there is a lobster pound, I believe, still. And just beyond White Horse Beach, up on the bluff, there was a boat livery, a rowboat livery type of place where people used to go fishing in the summertime, built on posts and such out over the rocks, 20 or 30, maybe even 40 feet below the bluff. And they had rigged up originally I suspect it was a so-called donkey steam engine of some sort, but it had been electrified by the time I was there, and they had a little platform on rails where you loaded your decoys and your lunch and your equipment and pushed the button, and it would go down to the platform where there was a no bigger than a chicken coop of a place to get in out of the weather. And then on the platform there were 50 or 100 16-foot rowboats, and you would transfer your equipment to the rowboat, and the rowboat would be set in a cradle on another set of wheels, and you would be launched off of that platform into the water to go duck hunting. But so I went down this particular first time with my 410 single shot shotgun to hunt what was commonly called coot, but in reality legally were scoter duck. They were sea duck scoter, white wing scoter. They're a scavenger duck, and the hunting takes place a half mile offshore, and these birds fly at 45, 50 miles an hour without a tailwind, which normally they had. They're big and black, and as a result, against the gray water and sky at that time of the year, they look twice as big or twice as close as they actually are. And you're in a rowboat pitching nine ways for Sunday and trying to hit these birds that are doing 60 miles an hour. And I used to get a big chuckle out of folks that would go up and shoot trap or skeet and get 22 or 23 or 24 out of 25. And I was in the high 20s, but I was never a 24 or 25er. So I used to invite them down sea duck hunting. And usually I'd sneak an extra box of shells because they would run out before they managed to get three or four birds, because they just had no experience out there in that kind of moving platform. So it was a good equalizer. But anyway, I went down this particular time with 410, and everybody laughed at me because they were using not only 12 gauges but a 10 gauge, which was considered a cannon. And the 410 is pint size compared to those two things. So I recall that we were out there, and I fired a number of times and without success. And there was a small group of birds that came into the decoys at one point, and I popped up, and my father hollered at me. They were too far away, and I just decided I hadn't hit anything all day, and I might as well keep trying. So I fired the shot, and I dropped three birds out of the five. Two of them died on the spot, and the other we retrieved and so forth. We got all three. So, of course, coming back at the end of the day with my three birds, all the old-timer pros were, my father was telling that I had shot three at once, and they said, "With what?" And I said, "Well, the 410. 410. Nobody hits anything with a 410 and so forth. Well, I was quite proud of the whole thing, but I was smart enough to realize that, leave that gun home next year, and I decided to buy a 12-gauge. I knew I couldn't duplicate the feat, and I've had that gun ever since. Been a good gun.
I guess those guys had to eat crow, didn't they?
Well, they certainly
did. Eat coot.
Yeah. Oh. We went out there one time, and we got some birds, and we came back, and there was a local fella. And evidently he had been after my dad for years and years and years to give him some of these birds and so forth. So it was a Saturday shoot. Bumped into Charlie. He was begging the birds, so my dad gave him some of the birds. Sunday morning, we're coming out of church at St. Bernard's, and Charlie comes along. And he went to my father, and he said, "Mr. Bowers," he said, "those GD birds you gave me," he said, "my wife, she cooked them up, she said, they stink of the whole house up." My father said, "Well, what do you mean?" "My wife, you know, she cleaned them and she put them in the oven." Well, as I mentioned, they're scavenger birds. So when you cook them, you'll bring out that aroma, if you know what I mean. And the proper way to utilize the meat from those birds is to lay them on the back, skin them open at the breastbone, peel the skin back, and then take the breast meat out, which is the size of your hand, and then you use that meat, stews, saute, onions, whatever. And it's quite tasteful. It tastes like liver, a little bit like liver. But if you do the whole bird, it'll take you a week to air the house out, which is unfortunately. But anyway, we get away from the club here. I do also want to mention that the club supported, through its revenue stream, was able eventually to support conservation and other hatcheries and stocking programs directly, and also through the Middlesex County League, I think it was called. It was a group of sportsmen's clubs that banded together, and the dues there were substantial and not necessary for the steering committee, which that was. But that committee then distributed funds to conservating, hunting, and fishing type of efforts that needed funding.
Locally?
Locally and around the state.
Such as?
I don't recall. But I do recall, and they probably still do it, they had a program for years where they would have a drawing probably in the middle of the winter, and two young, mostly boys back my time, would be chosen, members' sons or relatives or next-door neighbors or something. Names would be drawn. Members would put these names in a hat, and they would draw two. And those two individuals would go to the conservation camp out in the western part of the state for 2 weeks camping, group camping in a structured conservation camp. And they would get trips to the hatcheries and so forth, and education on wildlife and whatnot, training with a bow and arrow, and camping out in a ex-Army 14x14 canvas tent on cots and that kind of thing, and be driven around to various conservation hatcheries and things like that in the western part of the state. I don't know if they still do it or not, but they've done it.
We are still sending two or three kids every year to conservation camp and paying for their tuition. We just had two of them come and report to the members' meeting on Monday night about their experiences this past summer. Yeah. And the kids always come back with just very, very excited about the experience. Now I think it's done at Boy Scout camps. Okay. I think there's one down in southeastern Massachusetts that they use. The Middlesex County League has all but disappeared. Mm-hmm. But we do participate in a lot of programs that are run by the state wildlife programs.
Okay.
We've run programs on teaching women about firearms and hunting, about young people, about bird hunting, and we've run a lot of those programs at the club, which have been, and we've run a hunter's education program, which is sponsored by the state, I think there's a lot of interest. I mean, the conservation and our sporting interests go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of interest and a lot of support for conservation activities, you know, such as same kinds of things as, Ducks Unlimited and other organizations like that, even GOAL, the Gun Owners Action League in Massachusetts, to which we belong.
The Gun Owners
Action League, which is the local affiliate of the NRA, is a leading advocate for conservation interests in Massachusetts.
So would that suggest a dual membership then in NRA, or are most members of the club would they be NRA members as well?
I wouldn't say most. Many. Many are, and they are encouraged to become members, but many of the members say, you know, that's not, you know, we're interested in fishing, we're interested in conservation, we're interested in other, we're interested in, you know, target shooting and something. But they, so a lot of people say that's, you know, not where their interests lie, but because we're not just a gun club. We represent a variety of interests in the outdoors and outdoor activities, which happen to include the use of firearms in many cases, but not in all cases. But the especially with regard to Goal, they've been a very strong advocate for preserving, for conservation interests in the state. And the club is, as a club, is a member of both the NRA and Goal.
Yeah, but the NRA was, I don't think I ever heard it mentioned in my time up there. It was, we were simply a rod and gun club.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point they wanted to put the word sportsman's in, probably because of the Muscataquit Club picking up that name.
Mm-hmm.
And to broaden the appeal and so forth. But I think it was left, the Concord Rod and Gun Club,
yes,
after much debate. But, the NRA was not an organization that, at least through my time in the 60s, that was mentioned, really. Certainly it was not a topic of discussion around any meeting or anything. It might have been an individual choice, but certainly not anything that I recall hearing about.
I think that the reason that there was probably no interest back in those days is that there were virtually no restrictions on gun ownership. Whereas now Massachusetts is extremely restrictive. I think that is why people are involved in organizations that at least help preserve whatever remaining rights there are with regard to the use of firearms for legitimate purposes.
Do they still have the head of the state fishing game come to the meetings once or twice a year?
Well, actually, one of our members is the Ellie Horowitz is state officer who's in charge of hunting and fishing in Massachusetts, and she's been a very active member. And in fact, for the last 2 or 3 years, she has brought the New England Outdoor Writers annual meeting to the club. They have really enjoyed coming to our club, and I have personally prepared the luncheons for them, cooking, you know, and everything from roast quail to roast beef for them, and they're quite impressed with our club, and the New England Outdoor Writers Association, which is sporting writers who write for a whole range of newspapers and magazines.
And what kind of numbers do you get for that? How many come
to
that?
Oh, I'd say about 40 or 50. We also, another big activity of the club is the dinners that we now run.
What are you smiling about?
When he's mentioned that Henry mentioned that he prepared the meals and so forth, I remember the year that the last year my dad was voted in as president. I didn't happen to attend the meeting, and he was shanghaied, I guess you could say, to becoming president again, which he accepted. And the following morning at breakfast, he announced, he asked, offered me congratulations And I asked him what for, and he said that I had been named the new steward at the gun club. And I said, how could that happen? I wasn't there. I wasn't running for anything. And he said, well, I don't know, but you were nominated and voted in, so you're the new steward. And I kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, yeah, okay, well, whatever. And that following weekend, Sunday, I went up the club to find out what he had gotten me into, and discovered that the entire kitchen committee had quit. They evidently had had some kind of issues with the previous administration, I guess is the politically correct way to put it, and they were feeling unappreciated. So to demonstrate how indispensable they were, they all resigned. Nothing personal against my dad. They informed him. They had no idea that he was going to be shoehorned in as the next president, but just as a matter of principle, they were all done. So now I understood how come I was all of a sudden, that kitchen committee had been intact for 15 or 20 years. The members of it were ex-military who had cooked in the military and elsewhere at hunting camps and so forth, and they knew their business and could prepare meals and so forth. And a few weeks later, as was the custom, I suspect still is, they have a monthly meeting at which there was a dinner. So every month or so, one of the meetings would be a dinner meeting, and the kitchen committee would be empowered to provide typically a roast beef dinner. So part of the reason I went up that Sunday was to get a handle on when that was supposed to happen and, you know, who was going to take care of it and so forth. And I found out that it was a few weeks away, and I was the one and only who was going to prepare a meal for probably 50 people. So after getting the lay of the land, unlike these folks, who most of them were retired military or retired from professions and so forth, they would typically come up on the meeting night, which was Wednesdays, and they would be up there 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and they would begin to prepare the meal and play cribbage and kibitz and have a great time for themselves. I, on the other hand, was still in my working years, so I had things to do and places to go. And the first meeting, I had a busy day and didn't get really started as early as I had wanted to. And I went to the AAA market, which was over on Thoreau Street at the time, and we had a member, Skippy Hanna, who worked there, who was also part of the kitchen committee. And through his connections, we had a locker to store the game meat that the members put there for the annual game dinner. And we also purchased the roast beefs and whatever we needed for the monthly meetings. So I had my qualifications for being the steward were that I had worked at Howard Johnson's for a long time at the counter and in the kitchen, and had also worked in a little restaurant downtown when the owner went up sick, and my dad happened to be his real estate agent and sold him the house he was living in. So when he couldn't do the kitchen, I got volunteered to work for his wife downstairs in the kitchen until he could get back on his feet. So I had experience, supposedly. And but anyway, the afternoon of the meeting, I went up to get the roast beef, and they had these 20 or 30-pound chunks of roast beef, and I thought to myself, there's no way I can get that cooked by 8 o'clock at night. So I went and purchased 10 or 15 1.5, 2-pound roast beefs, and all the fixings, whatever I felt that I needed and so forth. And I arrived at the club probably at 4:30 or 5 o'clock, and sitting in the cribbage room, which adjoined the kitchen, was the ex-kitchen committee. And, where the heck have you been? What do you mean? Don't you know there's a roast beef? You've got to get this thing. And I said, yeah, there's a meeting tonight, 8 o'clock, I think, right? Yeah. Yeah, no problem. Well, you haven't started anything. And I said, what did I need to start? So they're all laughing up their sleeve, thinking that I'm going to fall on my face. I did too, actually. And but nevertheless, I opened the kitchen, went in, went to work, and managed to put out a feed. And for the first time in history, we didn't run out of well-done ends because everybody likes a nice piece of end meat from the roast beef. I had plenty of ends. Nobody had complaints that night. And next month was the same way, and then I threw a monkey wrench into it. I decided to do a leg of lamb without telling anybody. So I did a couple of dozen legs of lamb with apple green jelly, and should have heard the ruckus. What's this? How come? Well, we don't do lamb here. It's roast beef. I said, well, was that written in the Constitution? I don't see it anyplace. You know, too bad. It's roast beef. So that went on for a few months, and then one day, I'm not sure if it was John Dickey or Bing Bats or one of the guys, come up and say, hey, Jim, would you like a hand with cleaning up? Yeah, sure. And next time it was a couple of people, and because they were getting very frustrated that they were now essentially locked out, because I had picked up new locks for the kitchen and had the only keys and so forth, and they didn't have a place to play anymore. So eventually they decided that whatever it was that they were upset about was long since past, and pretty soon I gave out all the keys, and they were all happily back in the kitchen doing their thing, and I sat out in the cribbage room and played cribbage for the rest of the year. That was
But you also had an experience, did you say, cooking?
I do a lot of cooking at the club. We have the game supper, which is one of our biggest annual events. It's always oversold.
Right.
We run a St. Patrick's Day corned beef dinner. We run a roast beef dinner. We run an Oktoberfest and a fish fry and several other, you know, big dinners where we might have, 80 to 100 people attend, members and their families and guests. And we have, I have a lot of experience cooking for large groups of people. Mostly from working in a homeless shelter, where I have, cooked for, 50 to 75 people once a month, and I've been doing that for many, many years, and so I'm used to cooking for large groups of people, and enjoy it.
Yeah, they have the game dinner every year, and the year I was on the stewards committee. The kitchen crew had returned, thank God, by that point. And again, as I say, they had experience in hunting camps and ex-military and so forth. So they knew how to cook everything under the sun. But I quietly, over in the corner, decided to cook a large batch of breast meat from the sea duck, which had a reputation around the club of, again, stinky meat and so forth. So I very quietly cooked it all up and told nobody what it was and put it out with the rest of the meat. And, of course, everybody loved it until they found out it was coot, and then they all kind of got sick to their stomach. But up until that point, it was great until they found out it was coot.
Ignorance is bliss.
It is. You know, it's all. I think they were predisposed to not liking it, and when they did know what they were eating, it was delicious, but as soon as they found out what it was, they all looked at me like I had poisoned them. But anyway, it was a kind of a chuckle night that night. But there was, do they still have a cribbage tournament every year?
Yes, we do. We still have, that's a regular activity during the winter.
Serious activity, I might add.
What is it?
Cribbage, and we... Cribbage, C-R-I-B-B-A-G-E, or I-G-E?
A-G-E.
A-G-E, cribbage, and it's a card game played with a board to keep score on, and it's, you've seen cribbage boards, and they can be very elaborate, but we do have that. We have... What else do we do?
Well, the cribbage tournament typically runs for 10 or 15 weeks or something, a long period of time, number of weeks.
Yeah, this is a, there's a league, if you will, where you play against other clubs. And it's like the some of the other competitive activities where there's a group of sportsmen's clubs that have cribbage players who compete against each other, just as we have the trap teams go and compete in a trap league where they archery as well, and also our pistol teams are in a league where we have those. This is bullseye shooting, which is what it's called, target shooting, on a 50-foot range. And there's a group of about 8 or 10 clubs that we compete against in a league. And I don't know if there are any other things that we do that are...
cribbage has always been a part of my family.
Well,
we have a family trophy that anytime the family gets together. As a matter of fact, we just had a wedding down the Cape, and we all went down and stayed over. And the night before the wedding, the cribbage games got over at 1:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And my brother, Marty, the place we stayed in, had a plastic sheet holder. It was plastic, like a picture holder. And in it, it had a thing about quiet hours for the benefit of other guests in the hotel and so forth, which they had, I assume, on every table in every room. The room that I had was a suite of two rooms and a living kitchen area. And then my sons and daughters had a room. Marty had another room. But we all gathered in my room for the social part of the weekend that wasn't at the wedding reception and so forth. So we had they had a clam and lobster bake Friday evening. The wedding was Saturday afternoon. After the clam and lobster thing, we all went back to my place and dragged out the cribbage board and the trophy and began to play cribbage. Then we went round robin and so forth. And if you know Marty, he hates to lose. And the first game, my partner and I skunked him. And so for the rest of the evening, I had to wave that thing about quiet hours in front of Marty because he was quite vociferous about the game. And I think people who play cribbage quite a bit take a great deal of pride in their game and winning. And I know that's the way it used to be at the club. That's very, very, God forbid you should make an amateur move at the cribbage tournament and cost your partner and you a point for the tournament or something. You'd hear about it for weeks after that. But good-naturedly, but still you would hear about it.
We used to have a regular Friday night poker game, too, but I think that's pretty much disappeared.
Why would there be a loss of interest in a Friday night poker game?
Can't tell you.
Can't tell.
Can't tell you.
Uh-huh. I think the old-timers that played it all have... passed on and so forth, and
it was probably personal, personal relationships, and just convenient for people to come down there and do it. People find it difficult to get out for regular activities, especially now that we're getting, I think, a younger crowd. I mean, we get a lot of members who now are have young children, which has its pluses and minuses. The plus is a lot of them join because they want their children to, to learn about the kinds of things that we do. But it also means their time is very limited because they have family responsibilities. They're working full time. Now, probably in many homes, you've got two wage earners so that there's more, each of the family members has more responsibilities at home. This is why I was saying that and all these other things have seemed to eat into the membership of the fraternal and social organizations, but it has not, we have not suffered from that at all. We've got
I'd say every month we probably have at our board of directors meeting 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 people who come who want to join the club, so that our total membership has been growing. And that also provides us with a source of labor in the kitchen, for instance, mm-hmm. because we have a requirement that anybody who joins the club has to put in 10 hours of work before they become a full-fledged member. And that always gives us people to scrub the pots at the dinners and to wait on tables and to help with the cooking.
Do you call it indentured service or...
No, we call it, we call...
Application requirement is probably technically what it is, but that, along with that, there would be people who might be skilled in running a bulldozer or a backhoe or something like that, and when some road work or heavy-duty work around the club is required, somebody might bring the backhoe or something, but there's always room for a shovel to do the finish work, and... the archery targets need maintaining, and there's always something that needs to be done.
It's an apprenticeship. We call it educational and acclimatization and getting to know people. And it's a, you know...
And if they're not willing to do the work, somehow they just don't become members?
That's right. They don't become a... They don't become a... Yeah, so they don't get the right to vote, and they don't get a key to the club and so on.
So it's a cooperative effort, always has been at the club, to get things done. And if somebody's joining just for a place to hang out, they probably don't get to join.
No, that's right. So
let's check in with David just mm-hmm. for a second. Could you say my name is?
Oh, my name is David Wood.
David Wood, you've been sitting here very quietly throughout this interview. I wondered. Since you're local and knowledgeable about Concord, if you had any questions or if you could see any areas that we had not covered.
Yeah. Well, I was just enjoying, hearing the stories and hearing about what's going on. And there were a few things that I wanted to slip in, especially, a couple of things that you said, Henry. Henry was talking about trap shooting. And didn't mention something that you've actually mentioned to me. You have much more experience in this than I do, that Concord actually has one of the most attractive trap shooting ranges in the state.
I think that's right. Yeah. I've been to many of them, and it is a very, very pleasant, and people really enjoy coming to Concord to shoot at our range. It's a very natural environment. It's surrounded by trees, and it's a very natural setting. And we also, one of the things that we do and we're well known for is that the meals that we serve to the teams that come to the club after a trap match. The custom in the league is for the host club to serve a meal, and our meals are, people love to come just for the food.
But the, you